This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
I'm Paul Hawken, the author of Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. One of the aspects and the expressions of this movement is Living Dialogues, which you're listening to right now, and I urge you to continue to do so to build this movement.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in Living Dialogues. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. And with me for this particular program, I'm truly delighted to have as my guest, friend and colleague Paul Hawken, author most recently of Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Paul is known to many of you as an environmental activist, one of the leaders in the ecological consciousness movement, also in the social justice movement. He has previously published The Ecology of Commerce and co-authored with Amory and Hunter Lovins, Natural Capitalism. In this particular book, Paul shows how, in his experience and research traveling all over the world and doing great research on the internet, he's discovered that there are well over a million NGOs or informal organizations around the world that are doing the work of both environmental protection and social justice, inspired by a sense of participation in a living universe, which we all share and are under the radar in terms of media, but nonetheless are a source for real, genuine hope and optimism in our time. And so, Paul, with that introduction, I'd like to welcome you to the program.
Good morning, Duncan.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. And I must say, one of the ways I thought would be very good to begin would be for the audience who may not be familiar with you to have a sense of your evolution itself, your own personal evolution. Maybe talk a little bit about your childhood and an incident perhaps there that maybe became a harbinger for the kind of life work you've evolved into.
Well, I think the most significant influence on my family is that we're fifth generation Californians, and which is not a long time in one place, but it is a long time in California, because prior to that I was Spanish and then Native American. And so as the invaders, we go back fairly early to the 1840s. And in our family, we have records, letters, and oral memories of really what California was like, and how fast it's changed in the last 158 years, and the rate of development and the rate of, which is a polite word for destruction, that has occurred up and down the state and throughout, has been really rather astonishing. If you read the early histories of the people who came to California, they were quite astonished. The San Joaquin-Sacramento Valley was, to them, looked like Hyde Park. It was like great swaths of grassland punctured by these huge, you know, oak trees and great herds of ungulates that were so unintimidated by people that you had to sort of, you know, make your way through them, and huge masses of lilies that the Native Americans had planted for food, that had always planted more each time that they took some of the bulbs for food. And it really was a kind of a garden, sort of a permacultural paradise that had evolved over many centuries. And you know, too often and so often the picture we have of the past is a grubby one, and then Europeans bring culture and civilization, and And the Europeans who came here did not have that impression. They felt that they stumbled upon a culture and a civilization that was quite apt and quite extraordinary in the way it basically gardened the state and transformed it into really a place where I think the Miwok and other tribes would only have to work one or maybe sometimes 2 days a week to get everything they needed to live their lives.
And so what this calls to mind actually is Joni Mitchell's well-known song, We've Got to Get Ourselves Back to the Garden.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There was that kind of awakening in the 1960s, you know, with Rachel Carson in 1962 publishing Silent Spring, and that creating a real revolution of consciousness. It kind of woke up the culture in the United States from the sleepiness and the desire for rest and security of the 50s coming after World War II, and was the beginnings of a realization that our technology and our way of manipulating agriculture and our food source, for one thing, was somehow in need of a greater clarity and a sense of mimicking nature itself, of allowing nature to be what it is in an intelligent way and not trying to overly interfere with it and manage it and direct it and control it as an expression of human, we might say, even unconscious hubris here. And that's one of the great things you pointed out in the ecology of commerce, is that the very business economic model that we've set up in our culture is very distorted from that of natural processes of biofeedback and renewal within the natural world. So perhaps you could take us now to the next realization in your own evolution, having had that experience of being embedded, at least from an historical sense, in a kind of natural Eden there in California, even within your lifetime.
Well, it wasn't an Eden when I grew up, but there was certainly parts of it, and there still are.
That's what I mean, yes.
Yeah, and you could see it going. There were farms when I was growing up where there's now huge tilt-up buildings housing, you know, Silicon Valley firms. I think that when I was young, I mean, I had asthma all my life, and nothing really touched it. Medicines would suppress it, but they didn't get to the cause, and I changed my diet when I was 20 years old and got rid of the asthma, and then began to look around at the food industry. It was 1966, and at that time, there were health food stores where sort of people, there was women with white hosiery, you know, kind of like nurses selling, you know, pills and nostrums and things like that. But you couldn't get actually fresh food. You couldn't go there and eat, you know, for a week or a day. You could just, you know, get crackers and vitamins and shampoo and things. And so I did start one of the very first natural food stores in the country at that time. But, you know, it's like I was so naive in business. I remember sitting in South Boston where I started it, and these two guys were talking at a coffee shop, and I was there in the morning, one guy said, "Hey, Manny, I'm sorry about the fire in your warehouse last night." And he says, "Shh, no, it's tomorrow night." and it's like, I was so naive. I was like, wow, this is how they do inventory control in South Boston. So there was kind of this, you know, what's business? Wow. And I just thought we needed better food. And these MBAs would come over from Harvard, these MBA candidates from across the river, and do their thesis on the company and spend a lot of time and interview. And then they'd give me their thesis, and I could, I was marveled because the company was getting pretty big by that time. We had, you know, 100 and some odd employees and you know, several stores and a warehouse, and we owned rail cars, and, you know, we were growing, and they would present these documents that were really undecipherable to me. I had no idea what they were talking about, these different charts and graphs and terms. So the way I evolved in business is really to get something done. I actually have never been a big fan of business. I don't want to offend anybody. I think business is a place where souls really crash and delusions proliferate. It's always had that Midas problem that, you know, people hope that they can touch something and it'll turn to gold. I've always thought that business was really about making a difference and that you had to make enough money to do it. But if you set about to make money in business, you would probably fail, if not, you might not fail financially, but I think you'd fail in some greater way. And so I've always said I've been an outlier in the business world. And when I wrote Natural Capitalism, people, I coined that term, not Amory Levins, and I wrote an article 2 years prior to that in Mother Jones called Natural Capitalism. But really, the book was about natural capital, which is a term that E.F. Schumacher coined.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it referred to resources. He was trying to give a term to resources that economists to that point considered to have no value. Because from a pure neoclassical point of view, a tree had no value until it was cut. A mineral had no value until it was mined. And so what he was saying, no, it has innate intrinsic value. It's called natural capitalism, natural capital. So natural capitalism really was nothing to do with capitalism. It had everything to do with the idea of, like, what happens to a culture where the limiting factor to development is natural capital. In other words, a culture that's drawing down its water and its minerals and its trees and its forests and its fish so fast that it's going to wake up one day and find out that, you know, you can't eat money, as the Native American saying goes. And so the book was, again, not about capitalism or even business so much. It really was about a societal response to limits, the same thing that Dana and Meadows talked about in Limits to Growth.
And that's very interesting because the natural world is naturally limited. In other words, it has all sorts of feedback cycles and ways of renewing itself, but it's all based on the recognition of limits. And it recalls to my mind the deep understanding of economics, which very few economists actually recognize or talk about. But when Adam Smith and Ricardo first were talking about the invisible hand of the marketplace, there was this faith at that point, as naive as the faith that you had in how business works when you were in South Boston, being surprised at overhearing that comment of the fire, they thought that human nature was also naturally self-limiting. And as they were creating economic arrangements and systems in the marketplace to more fairly distribute the wealth and to give some sense of relative abundance and sustainability to people of all classes, that at some point this economic engine that was making this restructuring of the feudal society possible would actually begin to hum along at a kind of a sustainable level, that people would realize when enough was enough. And for that reason,
that was a cultural context which they imagined.
Yes, and that's why I was very interested being there in the Cambridge-Boston area when you were there talking about this, that your company was called Erewhon, which I thought was very clever. I understood it to be nowhere spelled backward, or that you already had a very early instinct that we were heading nowhere and we needed to reverse this whole trend. And so it was a kind of self-secret thing among us that were tuned into that and your vision at that time. So,
well, I actually never thought it would succeed, first of all. And so the name was irrelevant in terms of some branding. It's an anagram for nowhere with the H and W reversed. But it really comes from a book by Samuel Butler. And Samuel Butler wrote a book called Erewhon, and then later Erewhon Revisited, which used to be required reading in, you know, not so many decades ago, but now it's not. But it was a send-up of industrial England about a man who goes to a country. It's really New Zealand, but he doesn't call it a country, and discovers another civilization that has banned machinery, and because it enslaves people, and it's just upside down backwards. You know, when you're sick, you go to jail because you violated the laws of nature. But, you know, if you commit a crime, it means you're actually sick, and then you're sent to a doctor. I mean, it's just a parody, really, of the values that inform industrial England. And I thought it was very prescient, and so that's why I did name it Erewhon, because at the time I felt that our culture, and certainly our food system, was definitely nowhere, definitely upside down and backwards, definitely the low point in terms of Americans being willing to eat swill in cans and packages that was just absolutely made up of the cheapest possible ingredients meant to pander to the, you know, worst part of our taste buds, you know, salt and sugar and fat, and all of which we need, but we don't need them in the way they manufacture them. And so, yeah, there's definitely sort of a kind of statement in the, in the name itself.
Yeah. And now this is an opportunity to flash forward now, 40 years later, all of a sudden on the media, CNN and everywhere, we've got the big food crisis. You know, are we eating poison? Are we drinking poison? And you think about the power of the industrial state to co-opt terms. There was that book by Thomas Frank about the 60s, you know, called The Co-optation of Cool, where all of the attempts to create a renewed form of social interaction were co-opted by the advertising industry. And you wind up with Guess Jeans, you know, advertising Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs as rebels. If you only wear Guess Jeans, then you're cool. And you have that kind of bohemian consciousness. The word sustainable, the word green, even now, and the word organic are themselves getting polluted by the economic power here. So that has caused a lot of people, Paul, to feel somewhat pessimistic. Everywhere we turn and we try to do something, it gets co-opted. It's almost getting swallowed in the great maw of what Allen Ginsberg poetically called the machine Moloch of our industrial civilization. So
I wouldn't let it depress you. It's like, I think it's just a cosmic joke.
Yeah.
The thing is that As the hypocrisy, you know, you have to start somewhere, and people often start by lies. You know, they tell themselves lies or tell each other lies, but actually they're trying stuff out, and it's okay. It's just it's human nature, but I think what it does is it actually pushes and calls for higher standards. It keeps pushing the ball down the field. I mean, I think we should have a standard in this country called, you know, biologically produced, which is what the Europeans produce, and then let the USDA mangle organic as much as they want. I mean, because it's sort of a strange term anyway. So I just feel like it just keeps raising the bar. I mean, very much so in the way that we're talking now about not just how food is produced, but where. I mean, you know, who really wants to buy organic food that's flown in to, you know, sorry, but Whole Foods on big 747s. I mean, it actually countermands every single principle underneath the food revolution, you know, because whatever chemicals were saved and not put on the food were, you know, emitted into the atmosphere by the airplane and then some, you know. So, I mean, so localization now is happening very powerfully. When the big Wild Oats and the big Whole Foods came out, it really put out of business many, many farmers around the country who were supplying local food stores. And now you're starting to see these localization movements, these farmers markets and stores like New Seasons in Portland really, really honor place, really honor the local provenders and providers and artisans. And this is a very, very powerful movement in this country, and it has a lot of momentum, and I'm very, very enthusiastic about it. This is what Michael Pollan criticized John Mackey for in Whole Foods, and now they have bags, you know, that say, oh, buy local. But, you know, the fact is that it's very difficult for a firm that you know, a $4 or $5 billion firm to buy blueberries from a local grower. So people are moving on, you know, and they are, and at the same time, big business, you know, is trying to, I wouldn't say co-opted, but trying to move to where, you know, the people are. And as long as the people keep moving, you know, it's a dance, it's a game.
And that's what I meant about saying this sort of temporary despair, because what you've uncovered here in your great new book, Blessed Unrest, is that there is this great movement, literally, and moving energy that's happening underneath the radar. Your subtitle of the book is How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. And you actually, in naming the book, went back to a quotation that came from Martha Graham, where she said, it's this blessed unrest that keeps us moving, that keeps us marching, that keeps us being creative. And it's that which is really the life force. And I quote at the beginning of your book that comment in its entirety. She says, there is vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. You have to keep open and aware directly to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive. than the other.
Yeah, isn't that a great quote?
It's a wonderful quote, and you know, I see it as being very biological in that sense that you've talked about, Paul, in that there's a kind of organic dialectic, we might say, where as an organism intensifies in a certain particular direction, if it starts to become toxic or non-evolutionary, it will call forth its antithesis or its dialectical opposite as a source of renewal unless it actually becomes cancerous. There could be a tipping point in an organism where this desire to expand without limits, which we call a tumor, actually takes off on its own, and the entire organism in which it is situated is unable to stop this sort of runaway tumor, this limitless desire to expand and not be part of a whole, and then the host dies. But there are times you talk about it as an immune system in the context of the movement where our body will set the limits. It will get activated when something happens that's going to be too extreme or not in balance for the overall organism. It evokes the immune response. And you describe this largest movement in the world as humanity's, and we might say even the Earth's, immune response to this kind of runaway industrialism.
Yeah, well, this what the book talks about is the largest social movement in history, so large that nobody can really get their arms around it or measure it, and it is between 1 and 2 million organizations to address the environment and social justice, and it is also the fastest growing movement in the world, and it's fascinating why we don't see it, and we could go into that, but definitely, the way to look at it, to understand it, is to see it as nature, the same mm-hmm. revelation that exactly. Emerson had in the 1830s. But that we are ourselves are nature, despite our, you know, artifice and despite what we create as tools. The fact is that we still are nature, and there is something occurring, and that is quite remarkable, and that is our response to the insults and assaults and damage that is all around us to other people, to ourselves, to the places that we revere and love, to the sensibilities that we have, to the commons that we have shared for millennia. And this response I do call blessed unrest, this movement, and the metaphor that I thought best described it was the immune system, or is the immune system, because I believe what we're seeing is an immune response to political corruption and economic disease, mm-hmm. Ecological degradation, and the immune system is an amazing system, but in its simplest form, the first thing it does is identify what's me and not me, and something waltzes into your body, it's like a not me. It's like it doesn't necessarily mean it's a pathogen, but the body right away says, oh, that's not Duncan, you know, and Duncan, oops, not Duncan. Well, and that's the first stage of immune system, is to identify things that are not you and then decide whether it's okay to hang around or not. Well, in the same way, this movement really identifies what is humane and what is not humane. It says humane, oh, are you polluting a river? That is not humane. Humane. Oh, are you, you know, basically engaging in child trafficking for chocolate plantations? Not humane. And are you toxifying workers in, you know, Chinese factories to make cheap toys for big box retailers? Not humane. And on and on and on. And so what's happening is that human beings are arising, coalescing, collecting, or creating organizations to, in a sense, address what is not humane, that is to prevent and stop it. At the same time, to create real on-the-ground solutions to what is causing it so that it doesn't repeat itself if possible. And so there's two sides to this movement. One is to resist, as Gandhi said, but the other is to, in a sense, reimagine a new world. And I would say of the million-plus organizations, and it's just a rough guess, but I think it's pretty accurate given the work we've done on wiserearth.org, is that 98% of these organizations are about solutions. They're not about stopping things. They certainly want to prevent harm, but they're not only about that. They're really about reimagining, recreating solutions. It's a very innovative movement, and I think that's lost a lot in the media.
And well, the media ignores it totally. And I think what's very interesting about this great new open source participatory co-creative website that you've created, Wiser Earth. www.thebestofyou.org. In itself, it's a great resource that complements your book. About maybe a quarter of your book at the end of it is what you call a taxonomy of all of these different kinds of organizations that are flourishing in, we might say, the human earth ecosystem around the world. They're flourishing in abundance. And when we know that and we have access to know that, we can be inspired ourselves in our own personal lives and in the neighborhoods and the life systems within which we spend our days. And I'd like to invite you, Paul, to maybe tell people a little bit for 4 or 5 minutes about what is in this book, what kind of a resource it can be for them in reading this book.
Well, I think, and I can speak for myself, but I think I can speak for others, which is that, you know, many people have worked for a very long time on a variety of issues, or maybe just one, but all in together, a variety of issues with respect to the environment and social justice issues. And it's hard work. And we don't always succeed, and we get, you know, pushed back a lot by industry, by a corrupt government, by other institutions. And out of that, you know, can emerge a kind of a despair, a kind of hopelessness, a kind of a fatigue, if you will. And I think one of the important things about Blessed Unrest is that you get a sense, and also the accompanying website, but you get a sense that this is really big. And there's no place yet where you can get that view, if you will, of this movement, the scope, the breadth, the intricate and nuanced way in which it addresses the world. And when you read it, it's actually, I think we kind of know it already, but when you see it down on paper and see the diversity of this movement and the literally the ubiquity of this movement, I think it's a very powerful and inspiring thing. If you go to the website and then you have the ability to connect to it in ways which you've never had, you know, to organizations or people that do exactly what you do or your organization does around the world, then that's also very empowering. But I think the first thing I was trying to do in this book, Duncan, is really hold a mirror up to this movement and say, you're really beautiful. And
and you're here.
Yeah, you're here. And you're the largest movement in the history of humanity, by far. There's no second place. And how do you feel about that? And then somebody could say, yeah, but we're losing. And I'd say, yeah, yeah, but we're growing, and we're the fastest growing movement in the world, and the game isn't over. And isn't this exciting? But I don't mean to make light of it. Just the fact is that the immune response, to go back to that metaphor, always lags. It always follows disease. And there is a lag time, and there is a lag between 500 years of destruction and conquest, particularly in this continent, and our rising up, our response to it. And the response now is just accelerating so rapidly. And I think the other part of the book I think is really interesting is, you know, where did it come from? Because, you know, you mentioned Rachel Carson at the beginning of the program, and definitely, I mean, she was an amazing woman. And there was a real explosion of organizations that happened after 1962 when her book was published. But at the same time, even Rachel Carson was writing to a populace that had already been awakening. In other words, the reason there was such a response to her book wasn't just the prose style and her integrity, but also already throughout the country, people were concerned. They were in doubt. They had seen what was going on from these aerial sprayings of mosquitoes and other insects and birds dying, and were suffering from the ill effects of toxicity. And there really was already a population that could be awakened. And the same way that I don't think Al Gore's movie Inconvenient Truth really awakened as many people as it gave people a basis to start talking about something that they'd already felt aware of and knew about or were concerned about. And so when you look back at the history, it goes way, way back before Rachel Carson. And I think that's also very empowering for this movement to see that, because we think the political parties, well, they go back to the to the Whigs in the, you know, 18th century, and then even England to the Tories and this and that. And they have history, you know, and all these different institutions have history and religion, and universities in this country go back to the 1600s. But we just go back to the 60s. And I'm saying, no. We go back 2,500 years. And the rapid growth of this movement right now makes it appear to be new, but in fact, it goes back very, very deeply into our culture, civilization, and history.
And we see that people were motivated to continue in what you've called the largest movement that the world has ever seen, and it's been under the radar all this time. So this is what we'll go into now in our next dialogue. And so, Paul, I just want to honor you for your life work and for telling all these stories in such a compelling way, and then doing this immense amount of research, as you've done all of your life, to bring these threads of the web of life and the evolutionary impulse into a brilliant illumination that so well serves all of us. It's been a real pleasure spending time together.
Duncan, thank you.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. I've been speaking with Paul Hawken, author most recently of Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Be with us as we continue on Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, that's living, DIALOGUES.com. You can contact me at duncan@personallifemedia.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.